This is Words First, talking text in opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. It's the Monday before Election Day, and this is truly one of the most operatic election seasons we've ever seen. If you're listening to this on the day it dropped, I'd like to ask, have you voted? If not, get to those polls tomorrow. This is a public service announcement from your friendly neighborhood opera podcast. Our interview today takes us across the Atlantic to London, where I spoke with director, composer, and librettist Anna Poole, who is truly one of the most charming interviews I've had this season. This is not to say we didn't tackle some hard issues. We talk about writing sensory opera for disabled children, creating devised musical work about the Holocaust, and even coming face to face with that horrid troll, imposter syndrome. Anna's work is fascinating, mercurial, and steeped in myth and fairy tale, and what she has to say about opera as a theatrical art form is truly inspiring. Take a listen. Anna, welcome to Words First. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. So, as I said, it's so fantastic to finally see the secrets of the inside of the Tennessee cupboard.
So you're speaking to me from London.
I am. A very sunny South London.
Fantastic.
This will not last.
No.
Just for anyone coming in from the US, we do have blue skies sometimes. This is the thing. I'm looking at it right now.
It's wonderful. So you're a director, producer, writer, composer. Which of these came first, and how has each discipline influenced the other ones?
Oh, well, this is a long and winding road. It's been a really interesting journey. I probably, if I really thought about it, started out as a songwriter. When I say that, I mean pop music and musical theatre. Uh-huh. And that kind of kicked in when I was in high school, probably about sort of 12 or 13, realised I could do that, and that was fun, and I was going to be a rock star, 100%. as, you know, obviously. Also had a huge love of musical theatre before my love and interest in classical music developed. Which also came through some fantastic teachers at school.
As
often happens, you know, I've come from a musical family, but not necessarily a classical musical family.
Exactly.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
So they encouraged that with me, which was great. So big up to all fantastic teachers. I then, when I was about 15, got the directing bug. Just because of the opportunity through something at school and through the youth theatre I was part of, was directing a children's theatre show.
Oh, lovely.
And suddenly I realised that you could get paid to boss people around the stage. What was this? honestly, it was a really exciting thing for me to realise kind of about that age, because I've always thought in images. Mm. Whenever I listen to classical music, particularly non-vocal music, I've always thought in images, always thought like that, and it was really exciting to suddenly bring those things together and be able to put that out on a stage. And at the same time, I started to realise that I could write musicals. My rock star dreams had slightly faltered. I can, you know, do this stage work. Moved into writing musicals, and at that time was just starting to listen to, really started to listen to composers like Britten for the first time. And so a lot of my work started to move into that.
Mm.
And this very sort of odd thing happened where I got into the Guildhall School of Music and Drama as a composer. And that was not something that I had expected. I expected to happen. Went there, and opera hits you in the face when you go to Guildhall. If you didn't know it before, you're going to know it by the time the minute you walk in the door. It's a big opera school.
But don't you think that opera sort of hits you in the face when it hits you? Once it's there, it sort of smacks you. Regardless of what the outcome is on the other side, I always feel like opera just, if it's going to hit you at all, it hits you dead on.
Yeah. It's a bit like a train, like a sort of, full-on freight train.
Yes.
Definitely. And that was what was really interesting for me, actually, because I got there as a composer and started to go to opera regularly, partly through student performances at the Guildhall, and obviously being back in central London and realising that there was this whole exciting contemporary opera scene.
Mm-hmm.
Not opera isn't a dead art form. It's a really alive, amazing community to be part of, and does actually tell really exciting stories. And that was really, really liberating to realise. I suddenly realised that this was an art form that I could use to try new things, to tell stories in a way I hadn't before.
Mm.
It fed into a lot of the things I found really interesting: ritual and stylization and choreography is the wrong word, but just being able to tell such extreme, it's opera's bonkers, basically. It's so big, it's so stupid, and I don't mean that in a negative way at all.
Sure.
But the opera that I find really exciting is when somebody's realized that the only thing that can be told in a heightened way, if you're going to tell a story of total extremes, it should be told via opera.
Yes.
And I think people should lean into that, to that madness. Nothing annoys me more when I go to an opera and someone's done something a bit half-assed, and you're like,
right,
no, you should have just gone for that.
Right.
In a really interesting way.
So opera is such a collaborative working environment. Do you prefer that full collaborative environment, or do you like going it alone when you're writing things?
Yeah, collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
All the way. Quite seriously, because I noticed that you were interested at one point in asking me, have I ever composed and done the libretto for a piece?
Right, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I haven't, actually. So I might have directed and done the libretto for a piece.
Right, I did
notice
that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've done that quite a few times. Or perhaps directed and produced a piece.
Right.
Which is another kettle of fish altogether. I've never written and composed something, because I do not think I want that amount of ownership over a piece.
Interesting.
I don't like that. I think that what makes a piece the best and balanced is balanced relationships and balanced ownership within a room, and a true collaborative experience, where librettists and composers kind of have equal say, which I think maybe other people have mentioned in your podcast, that opera can be a composer-led form.
Yes.
And I do understand why that is. I absolutely do. You know, what makes it an opera? Music.
Of course.
That's the thing that stops it from being a spoken word piece. So of course it's important. But I want to be in a space where we can go back and forth when we're writing.
Mm-hmm.
I never ever want to do, I don't think, I'm just saying, I think, no, I don't think I've ever done a piece, and that's been I've been very lucky on that with the composers I've been lucky enough to work with, who also like to work in this way. So that I've never just written a libretto, sent it off, and that was it.
Uh-huh.
And the composer just composed from my work.
Uh-huh.
I feel that the composer should be into the dramaturgical process from the very beginning. You know,
yes.
even if they're not, they might be writing some themes. They might just be, you might just be talking about the dramaturgy and where you want moments of how that you want the pacing to work, how you want the drama to work from the very beginning. I think a composer should be in on the libretto writing and in on the drafting of that. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I want to hear their thoughts. I want to hear how that works. I also think personally, if you can, this is me having a lot of specialism of making new work.
Sure.
I think your director should be in the room as early as possible.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yes, I don't think directors are often... I think that there is a bit of an issue with the commissioning process, particularly for major houses.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those is just not... not allowing... instilling the time of a collaborative process.
Yes.
And understanding that that is a really important... That is a tool for like excellence rather than something to be terrified of.
Yes, I think it's actually a foursome, right? It's, you know, when you're doing new opera, it's the composer and librettist working in the best of worlds as a symbiotic team, and it's the director and conductor in the best of worlds working as a symbiotic team. And if the four of them are together, truly being a part of the creation of the piece, then I think that you're on track to make something that that is a whole when it reaches the stage, as opposed to being somewhat disparate pieces all trying to connect with each other.
Absolutely. And also not being afraid of change.
Yes.
You know, once it's written... And of course, this all depends on your scheduling and everything, you know, that sort of producer hat there.
Uh-huh.
I do understand often we're having to write things on very little time, and that's, which is perhaps another issue with the commissioning process. But
yeah.
I think, you know, why is opera not more like musical theatre in terms of how it works when it's being made? Mm-hmm. Why does the music arrive? And so often it goes to a rehearsal room and that is it.
Right.
It's like there is no room to change it. There's no one in, you don't have previews and tryouts. You know, you don't have tryouts where someone goes, that number didn't work, cut it, let's write something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that happens all the time in musicals, even now.
Right.
And I think what's happening in earlier opera world, you know, you hear about, I don't know, I remember doing Don Giovanni and doing a lot of research into the opera process before that and being amazed at how Mozart was just interchanging arias just on the whims of different singers.
Yes.
And of course there are different versions of Giovanni, different, you know, the Vienna version and the Prague version.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was writing different things for different singers and for things that worked and dramatic moments that worked and didn't work. And I always find it really sad that as an art form, we don't allow ourselves time for revision and change. And
agreed.
And that's, again, an exciting thing because that makes us enduring. That makes us have an enduring story that means things to people,
mm-hmm.
rather than a piece we play for five performances and never gets
exactly
performed again.
And gets put on a shelf and everyone says, well, it's exactly what it is.
And the company spent $100,000 on it.
Precisely.
And, you know, if it's a much bigger company, I'm talking about bigger houses, but do you know what I mean? I find that there's such an economy, or a kind of quite wasteful economy when it comes to opera. There's no thought that it could be a story that's enduring,
mm-hmm.
and something that people want to continue listening to.
Agreed.
I think that a more understanding of the benefits of a collaborative commissioning process might make that change.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of your libretto work. Can you tell me a little bit about Standing Together, which is the Holocaust Memorial Cantata that you wrote for Opera North Youth Company, and it was composed by Michael Bettridge, I believe that's
mm-hmm.
who you were working with. I read that the
yes.
youth company wrote personal responses based on what they had learned about the Holocaust, and that some of them actually traveled to the Czech Republic to visit Theresienstadt, where Brundibar was
mm-hmm.
penned. You said, and I have a quote from you, that you said that you saw your main job in this respect to be more a curator of their words, shaping them into the finished text mm-hmm. that the audience will hear. Can you talk a little bit about what that process was like?
Yeah, this was genuinely one of the most interesting projects of my career, in terms of the brief itself and the process, which is quite unusual, really. So Michael and I were invited by Opera North and their youth chorus, which is about 50 13 to 19 year olds.
Wow.
Which is right.
That can either be amazing or everyone's worst nightmare.
There are some real advantages to having such a wealth of experience within that 13 to 19 year old age gap.
Sure.
So we've been asked to, could we create a choral response to the Holocaust and its aftermath, and particularly considering the themes of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust this year, particularly with the 75th anniversary right. of Auschwitz's liberation. Mm-hmm. Their theme today this year was Standing Together, mm-hmm. which was all about reflecting on the need to fight against discrimination and injustice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no small feat. And this was going to be performed with at Leeds Town Hall for the Holocaust Memorial Day commemorations uh-huh. there. This was a really interesting process because, unlike traditional, and for your listeners, I'm doing inverted commas here, traditional libretto writing, rather than Michael and I doing the research, collaborating, coming up with a piece and giving it to the choir, we spent 2 months, maybe 3 months actually, once a week working with the choir, and our job was to facilitate their writing and uh-huh. their making of the work.
Did you find this an interesting way to work with young people?
It is really interesting, and one where you have to be able to constantly kind of employ all these different tools in your writing arsenal, I suppose, because one minute you're so there are some really direct moments in the room where, because you have to be ready to, there might be a day when suddenly a topic that your group really wants to talk about presents itself, and you must immediately in the room find and capture that moment. So I remember one day our group were really intrigued. We'd gone to the Huddersfield Holocaust Memorial Exhibition and talked to the families of survivors, because many survivors settled in West Yorkshire, uh-huh. which was quite a shock for a lot of our young people to know that. And they were interested in some of the materials we've been learning about how, what is our role as literally individuals in allowing genocide to occur. Mm. So things like, there are bystanders. People have to stand back and not do anything mm-hmm. when they see injustice happening for that to happen. People yes. have to collaborate to allow perpetrators to do that sort of thing. Now, obviously, these all have so many different reasons why people did this, but people were really profound reflections from sort of 14-year-olds saying, oh my God, what would I have done? Would mm-hmm. I have turned away and stepped aside? And so I was immediately writing all these things down. We're having this discussion. And in that moment in the room, I asked them in their groups, would they all come up with like a line or a phrase or something that reflected a bystander, reflected a collaborator, reflected a helper, who were people who, of course, tried to assist, in the case of the Holocaust, tried to assist Jewish people escaping or hiding them and protecting them.
Right.
And within that moment in the room, within half an hour, we had a full section of our cantata written.
Wow.
Because, yeah, that they presented their text, these really immediate textual responses to me and Michael. And then Michael and I used compositional devising techniques. We talked about rhythm, and we layered over all these rhythms, and Michael worked out what chords the group was responding to. And then we asked them as musicians, and of course we were going around to our groups as well, whether they would layer their lines that they had written over the top of each other. And so within half an hour, we had this, it was very Philip Glass, actually, I will say, in terms of how it sounded. We decided to go for a sort of momentum, dream, trance-like, two or three chords, so uh-huh. that they could fit them all over each other. And it became a real central moment of the piece. And wow. I was able to direct that piece immediately by also asking them to put a gesture. I'm quite interested in gesture. When it comes to pieces that build up in a sort of canon, mm-hmm. I find gesture it's quite very much like Peter Sellers's work, actually, yes. when it comes to him doing sort of lots of his work with Renaissance polyphony. Mm-hmm. And I was quite intrigued to see what would happen if we made them do direct gestural responses to their lines. Uh-huh. And we ended up with a piece that we made it in the room and it didn't change. And that was made right at the start of the process. And that when we saw that in the piece, that was as it was. And it was that was quite immediate. And then other things which maybe made me work in a more conventional librettist way sure. were when I took in lots of materials from young Holocaust writers of the time, because I should probably say we're very keen. It's such a difficult subject.
It's so heavy.
Right? It's so heavy, and it's so important that you do it right.
Yeah.
And so important that the information you are passing on is correct, uh-huh. because there is so much misinformation,
yeah.
that we were very keen that our young people never had to pretend they knew what it was like to go through it, uh-huh. because none of us can do that. So, which was why it was incredibly profound when lots of our young people were thinking, oh my goodness, I'm not Jewish, for example. I'm not Jewish. How would I have acted? Right. That was quite, so it was trying to look at yourself rather than you trying to be somebody else. So there were days when I took in work from writers who were their age at the time. So people like Klaus Peter Feigl, Renia Spiegel, Judith Ornstein, Anne Frank, of course.
Yes.
And we looked through all of these writers' words, and I asked them to see what resonated with them from what we had been working with, and then went on to ask about their emotions and their reflections as them, if that makes sense.
It does.
On those things. Uh-huh. And so I went away, so that was the much more sort of indirect process, unlike the one where we'd created the Philip Glass-esque moment that was all done immediately. This was one where I took away everything that was resonant and important to them from that session and essentially shaped it into part of a work that was singable, that went on a journey. And it was really interesting to do that because we had the materials from the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. So that it was that kind of took us through almost like a timeline of how these things happened. So that was very helpful to be able to use that as a tool all the way going into a set of very direct reflections. Mm-hmm. And we ended the piece very powerfully, actually, with what we called the pledge song, which was what we made that in the last weeks of our working together, mm-hmm. of things that our young people would do to ensure the fight against discrimination and injustice in their lives today.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, really powerful. And so we basically, with that, just asked them to write their own statements. And I didn't do anything to those. We might have ordered them in a particular way.
Sure.
But it was finding a really interesting balance between being a writer and then, as I said, being a curator
yeah.
of responses so that our young people owned that piece and therefore learned through it in a much more powerful way, right. and I feel our audience has learned through it as well in a much more powerful way than if I'd done the research for a piece and then we'd made an opera about it.
When I was a choreographer full-time, I used to work with movement that my dancers had come up with, because sometimes I felt like taking their own movement and then sort of orchestrating mm-hmm. it into a piece made for a more powerful connection to the dancers themselves. And I think it's a similar thing that they as you said, mm-hmm. they owned that piece, which I think I'm sure made the performance itself much more powerful because they were singing their own words that they held deeply. So I think that's really just fantastic how that came together. I want to also talk about Dust Child. This is a piece you wrote with James Garner and that you also directed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you like directing work that you've written?
Yes, I do. I do. I However, that has often just come about because maybe organizations go, oh, Anna Poole, she does both. Uh-huh. And that's a really nice thing. Rather, I'd like to make a big thing that I'm not precious with my words. Uh-huh. In that I really enjoy having other people work with them. Mm-hmm. I would go as far as to perhaps direct work I've done the work I've made the libretto for. I certainly wouldn't direct work I'd composed.
Interesting.
Because I feel that that's just too much ownership. Mm-hmm. For one person to have. And I think, as you're probably getting from these interviews, I'm quite a collaborative maker.
I find that actually most of the librettists that I've spoken to, collaboration is a huge, one, because I think as a librettist, when you're doing that type of writing, you have to be a collaborator. Unless you are doing it all yourself, unless you're writing the libretto and composing and directing, there is no way out of it. So I find that most people I speak to on this podcast are very interested in the collaborative process as a part of making art.
Because with Dust Child, as I said, it worked really well that I wrote and directed this one. Uh-huh. Again, I was working with James Garner and the designer Anna Driftmeyer. Uh-huh. Who is a total dream and amazing American designer. Doing both things on that was great because we had such a specific brief. That was a folk tale. Mm-hmm. It's an American folk tale about the creation of the star constellation, the Big Dipper, or over here, the Plough.
Is it called the Plough? That's interesting.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes, indeed. And it was a very specific brief from English Touring Opera. Mm-hmm. To create an opera for special educational needs and disabled audiences.
Oh, wow.
And so being able to do both of those things on such a specific brief that had such a specific aesthetic as well, mm-hmm. it just allowed a team, us, to work together in a much more kind of efficient and create in a way that we were able to sort of push forward on that kind of creative vision, if that makes sense.
It does.
Because there's so many, I also found that my writing style, which I think I mentioned it when we chatted in some of the previous questions, it rhymes a lot. Mm-hmm. I like rhyming. I like rhythm. I like patterns. Mm-hmm. in my words. I don't. I am very influenced by folk tales and fairy tales. I mean, you know, if I could write things based on feminist Grimm's fairy tales for the rest of my life, I'd be very happy. But there's something really important for the. We were working with SEND audiences, mm-hmm. but there is a huge spectrum of what those SEND audiences were experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so having patterns and things like that for children who, some of whom were sort of highly functioning autistic children who would be able to enjoy those sounds. Mm. And then at the same time, some of our children could only feel vibrations. So being able to understand, working in that respect was very interesting. And then it meant that we could reflect that in the set design, which was very tactile. Anna had done lots of pieces that sort of came up from the ground and had lots of textures. Mm-hmm. So that, because sometimes our children get up in the middle of the show and they just come on stage, mm-hmm. and touch things. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely when that happens. It's really lovely. And we had moments where she'd made beautiful Velcro stars under their seats. And I will never forget the moment of our first ever dress rehearsal in front of a school where at the beginning our lead character goes on and says, look there, can you see the stars? And they had found these stars under their seats too early, which was fine, and held their stars up, and they created this starry sky in the very beginning. And I do think that was a kind of a lovely cherry, I suppose,
yeah.
on top of a good process where our ideas, I suppose, had come together to match.
Well, it sounds like not only are you making an aural experience, but you're making a complete interactive sensory experience.
Multisensory experience, yeah. You have to find space for a start in libretti, mm-hmm. in general. Mm-hmm. When you see a bad libretti, not just for a SEND performance, but in general, I always think bad libretti are the ones where people just write a poem or just write a script, and there's a difference, you know, and there is a real difference, and you have to leave space. So not only was I having to leave the space that you'd normally find in a piece, but also try and leave room for these sort of beautiful tactile interactive moments. So we actually had water in the piece. One of our characters would go around and our kids could splash around in the big sort of pan of water that gets passed around. And so yeah.
How fun.
And there were moments, it was beautiful, and there were moments that I wrote where our dog puppet had a little song, and you know, and that just moments that also gave our audiences time to relax, mm-hmm. in a way that sometimes you don't consider when writing other types of work.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly made me think about how I write my, you know, work for the future,
mm-hmm.
Because of the experiences that our audiences on that show were having. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a profound effect on my work, actually.
Yeah. Another piece that you and James Garner collaborated on, East the Sun, West the Moon, that you wrote for, mm-hmm. what's the Tête-à-Tête Festival and Workshop in 2014. The photographs from that are so beautiful. And there was a pretty heavy use of puppets in that.
Yes.
And can you talk about your relationship to puppet theater? And did you write the piece with puppets in mind?
Did we write it with puppets in mind? Well, puppetry is just magical. And as I just said, as I said earlier, if I could stay writing fairy tales for the rest of my life, I'd be very happy. And I think it wasn't written that we would definitely make it with puppets. What we wanted to do was ensure that using very few materials and few resources, we could create a whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And it started by using a set of movable frames, actually. I don't know if you've seen that in the photo, there's sort of a set of movable frames that were decorated a bit like, it looked a bit like the alethiometer from His Dark Materials. Those wonderful old clock, that sort of clock looks. And it was about creating different spaces and different places that you could be just by the turn of a piece of scenery, mm. or the way that someone was standing. So it came out of necessity, actually. And then that was a very interesting one, because it wasn't so much us using puppets in the traditional way that we had marionettes, or that we used shadows in that respect.
Mm.
We created costume, mm-hmm. that had very symbolic, there's something wonderful about the ritual and the symbolism behind puppetry that is used throughout multiple cultures that we mm-hmm. see, that just has a place when creating fairy tales and creating fairy tale tropes, I suppose, mm-hmm. in a way, that appear particularly throughout this beautiful piece. Of course, there is a handsome prince trapped inside the body of a bear that is released by the excellent actions of his most feisty, technically the girl that he, the sort of feisty young woodsman's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's pretty excellent. And so using the puppets in that was a way of finding solutions.
Mm-hmm.
How did we have a singer who was a massive bass baritone, but was a bear, but was a prince? And when we didn't have any exciting, what was beautiful was when Anna Driftmeyer made this, who also designed that piece,
yep.
As well, made a beautiful sort of bear mask using mesh,
mm-hmm.
That was actually inspired by the Minotaur costume from Harrison Birtwistle's
Minotaur.
And we loved the idea that you could see the man inside the Minotaur,
right.
using just a small like light inside the mask.
Mm-hmm.
So of course we decided to quietly take that idea. but it worked really well, because it meant that we constantly had this idea of duality and worlds, which was really, really exciting. It meant that we could change things very quickly, and it I don't know, it was just wonderful, that piece, to see particularly adults who had come with children, thinking it was a children's piece, and often the adults would end up being the audience that was even the most captivated by this world. It was quite a magical journey.
There's something about pieces that are classified as juvenile that are really well put together, that I think that we as adults we tend to think that, oh well, that's a children's piece and somehow it doesn't apply to us, and I find that so completely false.
Totally false. The reason that children's pieces, the children's pieces that endure, the titles that I mention here, I'm about to mention. Of course, there are so many that have perhaps been lost for different social reasons, and I'm very glad that now we are making much more of an effort to recognise other authors, for example. Sure. The Secret Garden, which I assume has a resonance in the States.
Oh, quite.
As well.
Yeah.
The reason that piece is so enduring as a children's piece, it's full of death. Mm-hmm. And losing your parents, mm-hmm. and about child abandonment, and about parental grief, and about growing up. Mm-hmm. All these children's works are so enduring because they have such enormous themes.
Yes.
And we are so much more intelligent than we like to give them credit.
Yes.
credit for. We should never patronize a child on stage, ever. Yes. So, like, woe betide you who does that. So much of my favorite theater I've ever seen has been children's theater.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or at least is work that is directed as though I want constant wonder. Mm-hmm. I think you were very interested perhaps in some things that inspire me, and I always say, like, faith, myth and magic in the everyday.
Yep.
And that is something I know. I remembered you saying this, and part of the reason that people seem to think that with children's theatre you can put all those things in and it's okay because it's children, and then once you get to adulthood you don't want those things,
right? Somehow we're way too old for that.
We're way too old for this, exactly. And it's like, no, absolutely not.
Right.
I hope I always enter anything I write or direct as though I'm making a children's piece. And I do not mean that, as I said, it doesn't have to be the theme. I just mean in terms of children want to be spoken to like they are intelligent. Mm-hmm. People want adventure. People, you want to go on a journey and you want to be transported and intrigued, whatever story that is, even if that is a story about now in your house.
Right.
You know, it does not mean you have to write constant The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Right.
I just mean in terms of allowing us to experience, like, richness.
Mm-hmm.
And who doesn't want that disrupted sometimes by, we all want to, I do anyway, I'm always intrigued by what stories that place us now, and then suddenly, oh yeah, I've met my guardian angel on the street outside.
Right.
And how that disrupts my life. And I'm always really intrigued by stories that do that, which is why I'm inspired a lot by, faith.
Uh-huh.
Because faith stories, whatever they may be, have changed people's lives.
Right.
And have changed people's lives in because of things that they can't always explain.
Uh-huh.
And I love that about life.
Right.
We can't always explain everything. And I hope there is never a time when I know everything. Not that I'd ever know everything, but we know everything.
Yes.
Because then it takes the magic out of us living, and that
absolutely
is a very upsetting prospect to me.
Absolutely. And a particular problem, I think, that some people are having right now, the loss of magic. In 2014, with Teatro Vivo, you wrote a piece called White Cross Street, A Musical Portrait, which you list on your resume as a traveling street music theater work. So I'm just curious, can you tell me a little bit about that piece and what that was?
Yeah, of course. This was a piece with the wonderful Sophie Austin, who at the time was the founder and director of Teatro Vivo, who make theatre of place.
Uh-huh.
So I always make work about that their work is often site-specific, mm-hmm. and they make work that is created with the stories of that community of that particular place. This is a road that's just around the corner from Guildhall, where I trained, mm-hmm. and it's a very interesting part of London, partly because it's in the city of London, so that's the square mile. When you have the city, when you say the city of London with a capital C, that's the square mile where London was founded. Uh-huh. And so there is so much very rich medieval and early and Roman history there, going all the way through to the complete devastation of Second World War, because of course the reason that the Barbican exists, which for anyone who doesn't know is a big sort of brutalist concrete building, that whole area exists because it was destroyed in the Blitz. Mm-hmm. So it's an area of total regeneration, and yet Whitecross Street stands as a street that is just, it was all about the buried histories of that street. And so what we wanted to make was a travelling piece of theatre that sort of gave a nod to the mystery plays and the mummer plays of sort of the medieval period, mm-hmm. but that started at the top of the street, went all the way down through this enormous food market that happens every weekday, uh-huh. and that could sort of gather audiences on its way. So you could start at, you didn't have to start at one end, you could join us halfway through. And that piece was done by researching what was at sort of the archives at the Barbican, and looking at sort of local histories. And that piece was our response to those local histories. Mm. So, you know, we found out that the social housing on that street is, for example, some of the first social housing that was ever built in London, because Whitecross Street had such poverty at one mm-hmm. time. And we took the words of the founder of that scheme, and I really remember them because it was, "We are the uneducated classes, and we believe that people are born equally free," found that very, very powerful. Mm. And so at one point near these buildings, you would come around the corner and you would find a big group of musicians playing a piece that they devised using that text.
Right.
And then at the same time, we would walk to the local pub and found that, I hope I can say this on air, that the second most popular prostitute in 17th century London sold her wares from above this pub. Huh. And so one of my tasks in that was to research Pris Fotheringham. And I wrote a bawdy ballad in the style of sort of the Hogarth kind of era, 18th century Gin Lane kind of work. And that kind of happened in there. And then, so again, a bit, as you were, you know, 6 years on writing Standing Together, mm-hmm. you can sort of see the early beginnings, I suppose,
right.
uh-huh. of looking at all those kind of techniques where one minute I'm a traditional writer doing research, finding out the style of music of that time and therefore kind of almost pastiching it in a way. And then in another way, creating a soundscape that, a musical soundscape that reflected the Blitz, that used the sound acoustics mm. of the part of the street that we got down to at the bottom, because suddenly the whole architecture of the street changes. You can see where the bomb hit, the Blitz hit this end of the street. And people, we were working with sort of thunder sheets in the local hairdresser, which was quite a, people were quite shocked and intrigued by that. So that was a piece that was very responsive to the local history of the area, and that's a lot of how Teatro Vivo work. And if we'd had more time on making that piece, it would have become much more of a, refined is the wrong word, but much more probably of an expanded work, if that makes sense. Uh-huh. Whereas this was a little toe dipper that you, as somebody who was coming to get your curry at lunchtime,
right,
could suddenly find was occurring. It was like an intervention, or a, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Which was a really, that was a really cool way of working, because it was very fresh. We had to be very quick.
Yeah. So many of your operatic pieces also seem to fall into the realm of theater, or are divorced from the traditional opera house aesthetic. when you're creating a piece for an opera company, small opera company or a larger, doesn't matter, do you find that you think differently, knowing that it's going to be opera, or do you think that you think in sort of a similar fashion as you would if you were doing theater that just happened to have some music in it? Do you find that they all sit in the same realm?
I think it's just about having an understanding of how you communicate those stories. When you make opera, think of this as a director as well. When you make opera, you can't get rid of the music. That's right. What makes it an opera, right? You might as well write it like a play.
Right.
But I think, if I may be really honest,
please,
I see myself as a director who writes, rather than a writer who directs. So quite often I'm sitting here being like, oh my God, I need to talk about writing. And I know that, like, wonderful people like Lila Palmer are writers and they have a process. And I'm there like, well, I love to write. I write in ways that I hope empowers other people. Like, particularly, I'm good at doing community work when it comes to writing, because I like to empower. I use my work as a director in a way to empower other people telling their stories, and I want to help them tell them in the most exciting ways.
But I think you've just defined yourself as a writer right now. I think that's a really interesting way of looking at yourself as a writer. And my podcast was always meant to. Whereas I've certainly interviewed quite a few people who are librettists solely because that's what they do, 100% that's what they do. Mm. I'm fascinated by people who have their fingers in a lot of pies in the same shop. You know what I mean? And I think that defining the type of writing that you do, what you've said, is that, you know, what we've talked about today with you having so much interest in being a curator of devised work, even in the operatic realm, this is what I find so fascinating about looking at your body of work, is that you don't sit in a traditional, you've certainly had experience in traditional opera, but you don't sit in that. What you create has an operatic element to it, but is so much more community-based than what we would consider traditional opera aesthetic. And I am fascinated by that aspect of what you do and the fact that you write words for that. Let me ask you this. It's a question that I've been asking everybody. And I'm very curious about, both as you speaking as a librettist and as a director. What stories, you've spoken a little bit about how some things really need to be sitting in the realm of theater and plays, and some things really lend themselves to be sitting in the world of opera. What stories should opera be telling now? Where should opera be taking us now, in your opinion?
I honestly think opera doesn't... Firstly, opera is such a heightened world, and it's so wonderfully ridiculous. And then we don't use it in its full ridiculous capacity for taking us to places that even musicals can't take us. I love musical theatre, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's like my total dream. But again, like plays, there are things that musicals tell best, and et cetera, et cetera. I think opera forgets that it can be essential and interesting to our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think, in a way, that musicals, for example, remember that, and are really creative in their choices of, that's a really interesting film, for example, that captured the zeitgeist of the early 2000s. Let's make a musical of it, because it's not just a horrific money-making exercise. It can actually, when it's done well, it can actually be something that's very meaningful and very impactful for a piece. My example of this, and this is so not where you expected this question to go, I know that, but my example of this is, I think operas biggest missed opportunity is why on earth did they not get the rights to The Devil Wears Prada before Elton John got it as a musical? It's not a musical. It's the world of high fashion. That is an opera. Right. That is not a musical. Miranda Priestley is the world's greatest soprano role, yes. Maybe. And it just... It annoys me sometimes.
She's the modern queen of the night, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's not to say that it's frivolous or mm-hmm. silly at all. I'm not saying that we should just be creating fun frivolousness. But that is a story that people see themselves reflected in. Mm-hmm. And I think opera, sometimes in its commissioning process, doesn't think like that. And it should. Uh-huh. And I think it's very, you have to tread a very fine line between genuinely working with theatre as well. When you want to make a piece that's very immediate, rapid response pieces, right, about a current issue, because by the time the 2-year commissioning process is up, the current issue is sort of has either gone or has evolved in a different way, and your right. piece automatically feels out of date.
Right.
I want to make work that makes people who think that opera is not for them, I want them to see it and go, oh my God, I could have gone to an opera all along. because it tells us things about ourselves, and it takes us, the conventions of opera, particularly when we're talking sort of grand opera, mm-hmm. or even the conventions of opera within a mid-scale opera house, there are conventions, there are ways of working. Sure. That are just big and enormous. And I think we could utilize those things mm-hmm. rather than either trying to smash through them, which is what sometimes people always think, oh, well, we must tear it down in order to make it more mm-hmm. accessible. And I'm like, no, let's just say we're ridiculous.
Right.
and enjoy this fact, and that this fact can take us to new places and can take us to stories that matter to us, and we can have fun. I think opera, when it commissions new work, never thinks it can be fun. and I don't mean, again, I'm making it sound like all I want is to commission nice fluffy things. I don't want to do that. I just think that contemporary music as well gets such a reputation for just being piled on misery. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be that at all. The minute you take fun out of life in any situation, you're not depicting life.
True.
Because every situation has that in it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major reasons I think that a lot of people maybe put off opera is because they think they're not intelligent enough for it. And, you know, we take things out of it, we take certain emotions and certain people out of being seen on stage with opera, and therefore, you know, shoot ourselves in the foot as opera makers by making people think that they're not intelligent enough to come and see it. And they all get, right. and people get threshold anxiety and don't think they can come. And that is deeply upsetting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a director, another thing, and it probably slightly relates to me saying that when I direct things, I often think, or write things, I often think, am I doing this for children? You mm-hmm. know, that's the, yeah. how could I do this in a way that cites the harshest critics, which are children? how can I do that and make sure it's engaging so that adults will definitely love it? And when I'm directing, I often think, are people seeing this for the first time?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is so often a thing that particularly when we're directing classic work, that we don't think about enough. I think sometimes directors get very hung up on making sure that their Don Giovanni is like groundbreaking
mm-hmm.
and therefore forget that how they're doing Don Giovanni, random example, someone hasn't seen the original the way that it maybe it's sometimes done
mm-hmm.
and therefore can't enjoy your changes because your changes are you're playing against the text. You are assuming that somebody already has the framework in their right. life to mm-hmm. understand what you're doing
mm-hmm.
and that is not me saying we must always do period productions, please, no. That we must always do period or or non-innovative work, if we don't consider opera as an art form that can be enjoyed by everybody, it's not going to be.
Right.
And I think sometimes there can be, the opera world can would gain from being a bit more humble in that respect,
mm-hmm.
and really look at its practices as to whether it's just paying lip service to that idea, mm-hmm. or as to whether within its commissioning process and its, well, just all of its processes as a working entity,
mm-hmm.
is it open? Is it giving us things that do people feel that they can approach opera? That's my manifesto for when I run an opera house.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important. Anna Poole, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been a huge pleasure. This has been just a terrific conversation. I really appreciate it. I want to thank Anna for this delightful interview. Next week is the final episode of my first season, an interview with Canadian librettist Anna Chatterton. I hope you can join us. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stickhan.
This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Early Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.